Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money. And hold that money. And practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything. We'll be right back.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And mess around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Down. make sure the tarp's ready. We'll check with the weather service by 5, and we'll make a decision then. Hey. What you doing here? Don't you have practice?
Not anymore. I quit.
Oh. Well, since when are you the quitting kind?
I don't know. I just don't see the point anymore.
So you didn't make the dress list. There are greater tragedies in the world.
I wanted to run out of that tunnel for my dad. To prove to everyone that I worked...
Prove what?
That I was somebody.
Oh, you are so full of crap. You're 5 feet nothing. 100 and nothing. And you got hardly a speck of athletic ability. And you hung in with the best college football team in the land for 2 years. And you're also going to walk out of here with a degree from the University of Notre Dame. In this lifetime, you don't have to prove nothing to nobody except yourself. And after what you've gone through, if you haven't done that by now, it ain't going to never happen. Now go on back.
Sorry I never got you to see your first game in here.
Hell, I've seen too many games in this stadium.
I thought you said you never saw a game.
I've never seen a game from the stands.
You were a player?
I rode the bench for 2 years. Thought I wasn't being played because of my color. I got filled up with a lot of attitude. So I quit. Still not a week goes by, I don't regret it. And I guarantee a week won't go by in your life. You won't regret walking out, letting them get the best of you. You hear me clear enough?
So, Coach, how strong is Westview this year?
A lot stronger than we are.
You already written Friday night down as a loss, Brock?
Well, not if I know we could beat them.
Come here, Brock. You too, Jeremy.
What, am I in trouble now?
Not yet. I want to see you do the death crawl again, except I want to see your absolute best.
What, you want me to go to the 30?
I think you can go to the 50.
The 50? I can go to the 50 if nobody's on my back.
I think you can do it with Jeremy on your back. But even if you can, I want you to promise me you're going to do your best.
All right.
Your best.
Okay.
You going to give me your best?
I'm going to give you my best.
All right, one more thing. I want you to do it blindfolded.
Why?
Because I want you giving up at a certain point when you can go further. Get down. Jeremy, get on his back. Now get a good tight hold, Jeremy. All right. Let's go, Brock. Keep your knees off the ground. Just your hands and feet. There you go. A little bit left. A little bit left.
I bet he
does.
There you go. It's going to be good effort. That way, Brock. You keep coming. There you go. It's a good start. A little bit left. A little bit left. There you go, Brock. Good strength. That's it, Brock. That's it.
Am I at the 20 yet?
Forget the 20. You give me your best. You keep going. That's it. No, don't stop, Brock. You got more in you than that.
I ain't done. Just resting a second.
You got to keep moving. Let's keep moving. Let's go. Don't quit till you got nothing left. There you go. Keep moving. Keep moving. Keep moving, Brock. That's it. You keep driving. Keep your knees off the ground. Keep driving it. Your very best. Your very best. Your very best. Keep moving, Brock. That's it. That's it. That's it. Keep going. Don't quit on me. Keep going. Keep driving it. Keep your knees off the ground. That's it. Your very best. Don't quit on me. Your very best. Keep driving. Keep driving. There you go. There you go. That's it. You keep driving. Keep your knees off the ground. Keep driving it. Don't quit till you got nothing left. Keep moving, Brock. That's it. That's it. That's it. Keep going. I want everything you got. Come on, keep going.
It hurts.
Don't quit on me. Your very best. Keep driving. Keep driving. There you go. There you go.
He's heavy.
I know he's heavy.
But I have strength.
Then you negotiate with your body to find more strength, but don't you give up on me, Brock. You keep going, you hear me? You keep going. You're doing good. You keep going. Do not quit on me. You keep going.
It hurts.
I know it hurts. You keep going. You keep going. It's all hard from here. 30 more steps. You keep going, Brock. Come on. Keep going.
Burn.
And let it burn.
Ours are burning.
It's all hard. You keep going, Brock. Come on. Come on. Keep going. You promised me your best. Your best. Don't stop. Keep going.
Too hard.
It's not too hard. You keep going. Come on, Brock. Give me more. Give me more. Keep going. 20 more steps. 20 more. Keep going, Brock. Give me your best. Don't quit. No. Keep going. Keep going. Keep going. Don't quit. Don't quit. Don't quit. Brock Kelly, you don't quit. Keep going. Keep going. Go, Brock Kelly. You don't quit on me. No, you keep going. You keep going. Go, Brock. 10 more steps. 10 more. 10 more. 10 more. Keep going. Don't quit. Give me your heart. You can. You can. 5 more. 5 more. Come on, Brock. Come on. Don't quit. Don't quit. Come on, Brock. 2 more. 1 more. Oh.
Let's go. 50. Let's go to 50. I don't have any more.
Look up, Brock. You're in the end zone. Brock, you are the most influential player on this team. If you walk around defeated, so will they. Don't tell me you can't give me more than what I've been seeing. You just carried a 140-pound man across this whole field on your arms. Brock, I need you. God's gifted you with the ability of leadership. Don't waste it.
Coach?
Can I count on you?
Yes.
Coach?
What is it, Jeremy?
I weigh 160.
From the film, I highly recommend watching, called Facing Your Giants. And here this month on It's My House, while everybody's doing Black History Month, or a lot of people are, our version of it, we carved out two niches. Actually, it was probably three now. Slave Entrepreneur Month. We declare Slave Entrepreneur Month, where we feature stories about people that were legally born slaves here in the United States, or what we now call the United States, and became entrepreneurs. Some of them became wealthy entrepreneurs. Black Towns Month, former slaves that started Black Townships, and former slaves that basically formed their own counties or actual countries. And some that rose from slavery to president of a nation. So today our title is Slave Entrepreneurs, Kentucky and Africa, and William D. Coleman. Now, yesterday or the day before, we talked about, what's today, Wednesday? Yeah, Wednesday. We talked about the Republic of Maryland, the Republic of Maryland. Well, there were other slaves or former slaves that got together and practiced group economics, where they started their own. I mean, these people thought big. I mean, they were buying like 25,000 acres of land probably up to 2 million acres, over 2 million acres of land. I mean, these slaves, they, former slaves, they were really thinking big. They were really thinking big. And once again, this is all without no government help, no college degrees, no reparate. I mean, it's amazing what they did. So in addition to the Republic of Maryland, which was formed primarily by former slaves and some free blacks as well, out of the state of Maryland, today we're going to talk about Kentucky and Africa. Some former slaves that were born in Kentucky or were, you know, held in slavery in Kentucky. 'Cause once again, many slaves were artisans. They made things. They made brooms. They made mops. They were seamstresses. They were tailors. They were brick. They were masons. They, you know, metal workers. They knew about infrastructure. All that. So that's how a lot of slaves legally earned money. And I'll say it again. When somebody says this country wasn't designed for black people, no. This country was designed for capitalists. So the Republic of Maryland, and today we're going to talk about Kentucky and Africa, which is a similar type situation where some slaves from former slaves from Kentucky worked to buy their freedom. Then they practiced cooperative economics, chartered a ship from the United States to Africa, and formed the colony known as Kentucky and Africa. You can fact check me on this. It's right on Wikipedia. Okay, Kentucky and Africa. Marcus Garvey wasn't even a thought during this period of time. Okay, so let me read about it. I'm on Wikipedia. Kentucky and Africa was a colony settled by freed African-American slaves in present-day Montserrat County, Liberia. All right. So, if you know what, people, I would love to do a field trip to these places. So, if you're interested, contact me. Let's organize something. Let's go back to Africa, and let's visit Maryland County, which at one time was its own nation. For 23 years, it was its own nation, recognized by sovereign countries around this world, Republic of Maryland. Today, it's Maryland County, Liberia. The other place that we can visit is this place we're talking about today, Kentucky and Maryland, I mean, Kentucky and Africa, which now is known as Montserrat County, Liberia. All right, a Kentucky state affiliate of American Colonization Society was formed in 1828, and members raised money to transport to Kentucky. Now, mind you, Abraham Lincoln's not even in office. They're not talking about, you know, emancipation. Slavery was in full tilt in 1828. But through the free enterprise capitalist system, even slaves were allowed to earn money and get a vested interest in this capitalistic system. Okay, let's see. The Kentucky Society bought a 40-square-mile or 100-kilometer site along the St. Paul River. Now, imagine this now. former slaves, people that were born into slavery. Now, talk about, see, some of you are whining about, well, we didn't get our 40 acres and a mule. And there's been a never-ending barrage of, conversations on talk shows, including here on It's My House, about reparations some people want to check. And now you've got some, you know what, in Evanston, Illinois, and there's some other cities, but in Evanston, Illinois, the local government passed this reparations bill, which isn't based on slavery at all. But with the Kentucky and Africa, and once again, you can fact check me, they got together former slaves and bought a 40-square-mile tract of land. 40 square miles. Get on your, let's figure this out now. Go to any search engine, and you want a square miles to acre calculator. Okay. So, 40 square miles. Okay, 40 square miles is 25,600 acres. They were thinking big. Unfortunately, many of the, not all, but many of the reparations crowd in 2022, you're not thinking big enough. And you want it to come from the government. These people knew what they had to do, and they did it. So if they can do it with no internet connection and all this other stuff, we should be able to do a lot more today. In any event, Kentucky in Africa was annexed by Liberia in 1847. And I like to take a field trip there because we'll gain information there on the boots on the ground and we're not going to get here on Wikipedia. So people that are interested in that, contact me directly. And we can start planning this. You can contact me through our Facebook page, which is It's My House TV, or you can text me at 425-520-0605. Now, the other person that we want to feature today, in Kentucky and Africa, was a group economics project that was successful. Now, David D. Coleman, he was a politician. Let's read about him. William David Coleman, sunrise July 18, 1842, sunset July 12, 1908, was an American, was an Americo-Liberian politician, a true Whig Party member. He served as the 13th president of Liberia from 1896 to 1900. He was born in Fayette County, Kentucky, United States. He immigrated to Liberia in 1853, 10 years before the Emancipation Proclamation in this country. In 1877, he was elected to the House of Representatives, in Liberia, that is, and served as Speaker of the House of Representatives in 1879. Later, he served in the Senate in Liberia and then as vice president before assuming the presidency when Joseph James Cheeseman died in office. His early life. Of mixed race background, Coleman was born a slave. Let me read that again. Coleman was born a slave in Fayette County, Kentucky in 1842. He immigrated to Liberia with his family when he was 11 years old. Upon their arrival, the family consisted of William, his widowed mother, Ellen, and three others, all of whom settled in Clay Ashland near Monrovia, that still exists today, people. Coleman trained as a carpenter. Once again, many of these former slaves got their freedom by becoming artisans. His artisan trade or craft was he became a carpenter, and he made money that way. As a slave, to get his freedom, and accept in this free enterprise system of the United States. He wasn't crying about white supremacy and had other manual labor jobs before becoming successful, becoming a successful trader. Studying at night, he picked up the education he had abandoned as a child when poverty prevented further schooling. I mean, this guy's phenomenal. On President's Day, and is President's Day this month, February? Or did we already have President's Day? President's Day. Let me look that up real quick. I'm going to start celebrating President's Day in these colonies that the former slaves set up. Okay, President's Day, that's on February 15th. It's not here yet. All right, so anyway, now, here's a guy, because nobody listening to this podcast right now was born a slave. He didn't get any reparations. He didn't go to the social services office. To my knowledge, I don't even think these people were marching and protesting back then. What they did, their way of protesting, is become an entrepreneur and start making things, set up your own business with stuff that you've made. And because a lot of his customer base was white folks. He had some black folks too, but, you know, business is business. And, you know, pull your resources together, partner up with or joint venture with other people. I mean, this guy went from slave to president of a nation. William D. Coleman. So now if you're on Blog Talk Radio, if you go to our scrolling marquee online, there's a picture of him. And let's see. There's also a map where you get an idea with Kentucky and Kentucky and Africa was. All right, so that's something I'm going to organize, people. Let's go over to Liberia and then visit some of these, what I would call sacred counties that used to be their actual own sovereign nation. Because you've got... Well, we covered Maryland yesterday. Today we covered Kentucky. Let's see. And, you know, we can, like I said, we're going to get information that we're not going to get over here. I mean, we want to check out their libraries. Okay. And their historical sites. So anybody interested in that, matter of fact, what's today, Wednesday? I'm going to call my travel agent and start getting the particulars on that, on a group travel. So, people, we're doing a It's My House road trip to Africa. I'm going to get some basic costs down, and I would love for you guys to join over there. On that note, let's go balling on Baltic.
Before I get started with this video, I just want to personally thank the brother Fred Hassan Powell of the Morale Facebook page for sharing this social political cartoon, which is currently displayed in this video. I always big up brothers who are artists like him, my man Will James, Alex K. Art, Chris Miller, and others, because their pictures speak volumes. They don't have to say one word because, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. In fact, I want y'all to take a good look at this picture, which shows a brother with his hat flipped to the back telling the bald-headed brother that he's hungry as fuck. When the brother attempts to hand him his own fishing rod so he can get some fish on his own, he gets verbally assaulted. No, nigga, I want some fish. Fuck out of here with that coon shit. Man, if you look closer, you'll see that the brother that says he's hungry got a fresh pair of Jordans on his feet. And once again, I want to thank you, Fred, for sharing that photo because it is a perfect warm-up for what I'm getting ready to bring up next. Look, last week, I had to stop past a gas station, and when I went in, I took a quick glance over to the newsstand, and I saw the Washington Post. The first thing that caught my eye was something that you normally don't see on the cover of a newspaper, which was a few straggling pants sagging brothers sitting on a stoop of a building outside. I didn't have the time to read the paper in the gas station because I had to fly, but I checked the article online when I got home, and I was just flabbergasted. I want you all to check it out for yourself in the description box. It is the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, and the front cover story is a look back at the riots which took place in Baltimore this past April following the death of Freddie Gray. The Post took the time to interview a few of the residents and get their personal take on how things have been and has any positive change come to the streets of Baltimore after the riots. And one of the brothers that they interviewed was a young man that was out there on the streets peddling drugs from time to time, and he stated that he ended up finding out shortly after the riots that there were a few storefront apartments that were up for sale and that they were only selling for just $5,000 a piece. He then said that when he ran the idea of getting together and investing in the neighborhood past several brothers that he was out there selling drugs with on the streets, all of them told him no. And see, this goes to what brothers like myself, Sean James, and many others who are right here on YouTube have been telling y'all about this modern Negro. Okay, this Baltimore brother that was interviewed by the Washington Post had a great idea and the right frame of mind to purchase this storefront property while the price is extremely low. But the rest of the Negroes that are around him ended up dragging him into the quagmire of apathy that surrounds the Negro landscape.
Shit, dude. Pick that bitch on your face. Shit, dude. Your ass. That bitch scared, nigga. Oh. Beat her motherfucking ass. She's like you, motherfucking nigga. Beat her motherfucking ass.
That nigga can't. That nigga hurting himself.
You from Nuke State.
Look, the main spot that this brother was looking to purchase had five rooms between both of the upstairs levels, and it just needed a little bit of furnishing. These spots could have easily been rented out to tenants or used as cheap housing by family and friends that could have worked a legitimate business out of that storefront. The Negro just don't get it, because the more legitimate storefronts, strip mall shops, apartments, and tenements you own would lessen the police targeting you, because then you could do what the foreigners and white folks that own these places do, which is hire the police to work security at your properties and places of business. Why do you think they don't go upside the heads of these foreigners? Because they step to the police officers and let them know that they have work for them. These foreigners and white folks that own and run these storefronts hire the cops, and if they don't pay them with cash, they give them free merchandise and meals on the house, so they in turn look out for them. And half these cops do moonlighting security at these places even when they are on duty, because all they got to do most of the time is just drive through with a squad car or do a quick foot patrol right near the business or apartment housing units that are being rented out. This is why they don't give the Chan family or any Chinese youngster any problems when they see them in the hood by their dry cleaners. This is why they don't bother Mr. or Mrs. Akbar or any Arab kids that they see near the gas stations they own. This is why they don't mess with Miss Yee or any of her grandkids that are close to the nail salon she owns. Because they take a small percentage of the proceeds and pad the local policeman's pockets. And see, your typical foolish Negro that would challenge what I just told you will say, well, see, you insinuating that we got to bribe the police for them to stop brutalizing us. But they, like most, don't know anything about capitalism. It is a game of economic musical chairs. I just gave you the analogy when I mentioned all the foreign families that own all the storefronts, strip malls, and rental properties. Who is the only one who is left standing up with no businesses or property to speak of when the music is done playing and the cops roll through the neighborhood? That's us, yapping back and forth when the music stops and they tell our loitering asses to get moving or catch a bruising. That's us, walking around with sagging pants and glow-in-the-dark fluorescent color wigs like this sister that you see right here tossing rocks during the riot last April. Now, she's throwing rocks and expressing her anger and frustration, but she has a fresh weave on top of her head, which helped pay some of the officers that broke Freddie Gray's back. So who is the sellout and coon, black folks? And think about it. If you own some of those storefronts and control the flow of unlaundered, legitimate-made currency that comes through those areas, you can do your illegal dirt all day long without that much harassment from the local authorities. You might draw attention from a few alphabet gang organizations like the DEA, FBI, and others, but the local guys aren't going to pay that much attention because you're helping them pay bills and you're putting food in their stomach. And since I brought up the subject of illegal activity and you pants-sagging clowns love to talk about how gangster you are, why don't you do what some of the Irish, Italian, Jewish, and Polish immigrants your dumbass keeps trying to emulate did by legitimizing some of your hustles and using the same police force that chases you around the neighborhood as a shield. See, most Negroes will try to tell you that we are always at the end of a nightstick, a baton, or getting showered with bullets just because we are black. But ask yourself a question. Why aren't that many Ethiopians and West Africans getting mollywopped and punished to the extent that many so-called African Americans are in the U.S.? Remember, they're just as black and sometimes way darker than us. But why are there fewer cases of them being brutalized and killed by the police like we saw with Amadou Diallo or Abner Louima, both of which took place in New York? Why so few cases compared to us so-called Afro-Americans? It's because they're smart enough to own businesses, restaurants, furniture stores, parking lots, etc., and pay the cops to look the other way so their fellow countrymen aren't harmed in any way. That's the logical thing to do. But you can't tell this Negro from America that because you're still living off the backwards principle and creed of entitlement, which these liberals drafted up for us long ago. Instead of assessing this situation from a global perspective and seeing that everyone else seems to be purchasing everything around us so they can live comfortable lives and keep us at a position of marginalization as opposed to putting themselves in that boat, the Negro man and woman in the U.S. will counter it by saying, see, I object because my tax dollars pay for the police not to harass me. No, they don't, you imbecile. Especially after Uncle Sam rapes their paycheck just like he rapes everybody else's. Now, your pro-whack movement pseudo-black nationalist leaders will call me a coon for telling you this, but this is something that they know firsthand. They also know that you more than likely won't view this phenomenon from all angles because you're still under the influence of the can't we all just get along flavor Kool-Aid most black folks drank after the post-civil rights movement era, thinking that all the bigotry-enhanced physical assaults and beatdowns we took during chattel slavery and Jim Crow had an exclusive cutoff date to them. Which is why every single year one of these highly publicized police brutality incidents takes place, there's some dumb Negro that says, I don't believe that in 2087 this is still happening to black people. Yeah, it is. And it's going to keep on happening in 2088 if you don't adopt a different way of thinking, dummy. Your pseudo-black nationalists won't tell you that you are mostly to blame for this continually happening, because they want you to keep feeling sorry for yourself and attend more lectures and debates where they argue over whether or not a woman is God or which master teacher's philosophy is better to follow. But I'm here to tell you right now, black folks, that we don't need to attend a gazillion seminars, travel with a million other jugheads to commemorate the anniversary of a march that never led to mass black improvement, or study the teachings of some philosophical doctor with 10 degrees to find a solution to our problem. This brilliant brother from Baltimore that was interviewed in the December 9th edition of the Washington Post, who more than likely didn't even finish high school, just gave us the answer. And if you're wondering why I titled this thing Ballin' on Baltic Avenue, I did so as a way of saluting one of my grandfathers. See, long ago when I was a very little boy, he taught me how to play Monopoly. I was about 7 years old, and I was all geeked up racing around the board to buy Boardwalk and Park Place. And he said, go right on ahead. He let me do it and said, I'll just buy a Baltic, Mediterranean, Oriental, and all these other properties that you aren't even thinking about. So as the game went on, and I only owned Boardwalk, Park Place, and Pacific, I think, he had all the other properties, the railroads, the waterworks, the electric company, and a whole bunch of hotels and houses on all of them while I was looking silly. And I ended up having to sell what I owned and wait for that $200 paycheck once I passed go. Once it finally set in that I lost the game, he chuckled and told me, son, you got to own what's in the ghetto before you walk around the block. And that lesson that my grandfather Dave, rest his soul, taught me still applies to this very day. Ownership is a universal language, no matter what culture or ethnicity you come from, because it regulates the sort of relationship you're going to have with most of the people around you.
Yeah, and I remember I read The Richest Man in Babylon. That was the one out of the three that I read.
That's the only one you read?
That's the only one out of the three that you mentioned that I read. But I've read a lot of books in general.
You're slipping.
I'm slipping? Well, I'm going to read the other two. I'm going to read the other two now that I see your breakdown. But there was a whole thing about The Richest Man in Babylon, like the guy that became a slave and ended up buying himself out of slavery and becoming rich at the end.
Literally, he could have ran Babylon if he wanted to.
Right. But before he basically ended up in slavery, he had owed a whole bunch of people money.
No, that's a different one.
Oh, it's a different one?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the camel trader.
The camel trader. Okay. You know stuff better than I do. But I remember in that particular story.
I read it 25 times.
Okay, I read it once. Or maybe twice. But in that story, he was saying how when you owe a whole bunch of people money and have a bunch of debt, you're really a slave anyways. You're in a slave mentality.
Well, most people are slaves anyway because they spend all the money that they make.
Exactly.
Every time they make money, they got to go, you know, pay Michael Jordan. They got to pay the rent man, the car guy, everybody. He said, fool, you're paying everybody but yourself.
Exactly.
So, yeah. But that's not the one that I like the best. My best story is The Luckiest Man in Babylon.
Right. Next book, Think and Grow Rich. What is it about that book?
Well, Think and Grow Rich, what he taught me is that think your way into a position, but the best part is the mastermind group, how you take yourself and you put these different people around you that do things that you're not good at. I was doing that already, you know, when I was in the drug game. I was already putting around, but I didn't really understand how I could target people. Like right now, I target people. I specifically go after certain people, almost like a football team goes after a running back. Now I'm going after people to put in places that I want them in. And I'm doing that consciously, more consciously than I was when I was in the drug business. So those are really the two key points that I learned. I also learned about the burning desire. A burning desire is what I had in the drug business, where I was willing to die or kill to continue to sell drugs. So that would be considered a burning desire, which Napoleon said you should never do either one of those. You shouldn't put your life or your freedom on the line, you know, to be successful.
Yeah.
And that's what I was telling you about these other guys. Once they find out that if they put that same type of energy into these other businesses, that they're going to thrive.
Oh, yeah. If you don't wake up in the morning and the first thing you do is think about your business and check to see what happened while you were asleep and strategize based on those moves, you're probably in the wrong business. You agree?
I agree.
Yeah.
I dream about my business at night.
Yeah. And the final book is As a Man Thinketh, which I've actually never heard of.
No?
Yeah. Tell me what it is about that book.
Well, that book taught me that my mind is a muscle and that if I exercise it, that it would grow. Just like if I took a weight and started lifting my arm, my bicep would grow, where my muscle and my mind would grow, that our mind is a muscle and that it's like a garden. And with a garden, if you don't clean it, weeds will overtake the garden and you won't be able to get any fruit out of it, that it'll just produce weeds. He also taught me that you can't plant nettle seeds and pray for corn. No matter how much you pray, you're not going to get corn if you plant nettle seeds. So you have to plant seeds of fruit that can be eaten if that's what you want. You know, if you want a useless, wasted plant, then you plant nettles. Most people don't know what nettles is, but I'm from the country, so I know. A nettle is a bush that it itches your hand like crazy, almost like poison ivy, so you don't want to have nothing to do with a nettle. I done been stung by a few.
You got it.
So I got that out of As a Man Think. That's just part of it. I also got, he talks about a young boy being a slave. And even though he's a slave, he takes every waking moment and he's thinking about being free. So what that tells me is that if you're not in a position that you want to be in, then your mind should be totally focused on that, and you shouldn't be sidetracked with all the other things that go on around you in the world, you know.
Dope. I'm going to read these two. I'm going to read the two that I haven't read yet, and there'll be links below so the viewer can actually check them out too, as well as your book as well.
Yeah. Well, my book is accumulation of all the books I read with my experiences. I was watching today a little bit of our interview, and, and I was telling you about how people are really slipping on my book. But one day, you know, it's going to sell like I won't be able to keep them, you know, once they see the moves that I've been able to make by using those principles. People are going to take their hat off and say, job well done.
Great books. I read them both.
Yeah, you read both of them?
I read them both. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here, but the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, Yupa makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe. But they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. Yupa runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at Yupa in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of Yupa's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not Yupa. To slash costs and stay competitive, Yupa builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away.
3000个，赶快送过来。好，这边没有了，已经没有了。是是。
But even the supplier is dangerously low on stock.
大概因为现在生产线已经停掉了，然后我大概要赶快把它送过去哈。好的，一点钟整装来送掉。对对对。
Mr. He has found barely enough parts to last the day.
好，谢谢谢谢。好。
When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. Yupa started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year. But Yupa wants more.
前进走，前进走，加油，看车，上车，看。
Little wonder Lu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. Yupa's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down, unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply, and soon.
If we don't get them the parts, six production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly line. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988. In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yupa is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only 2 daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work, and there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed. Finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupa and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Lee.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Li Yang Li works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yupa in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yupa management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, Yupa could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Lee's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Lee's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yupa workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yupa. Chef Xingming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xingming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Li runs one of five independent restaurants at Yuba. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin. And Li needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yupa.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yupa churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year. But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Li expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Li's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, we still didn't have much food to eat.
Now food is never in short supply, and all of Li's clients return to work with their bellies full. Li's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Li controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasoning that you can't get from the market.
Li insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Li's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Ya Shin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job? Address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 US dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenants' rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
挑战是里面员工有17,000多人, 那来自
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low. Yupa has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Fu keeps them in line.
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants. But they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit. A veteran on these streets, Fu recognizes this woman. He busted her once before. Today, Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at Yupa.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.
China's web of cultures complicates Fu's job.
Everyone comes from different families and different provinces, so their customs of eating and living are totally different, so I have to adapt to them.
But one thing unites all of Yupa's workers, the world's most popular sport. On the field, tension and stress vanish.
Because employees are undergoing a lot of pressure at work, we have to give them an outlet and let them exercise. But most important is the team building.
Don't care for soccer? Yupa offers other ways for workers to get their exercise.
For entertainment, we have ball game competitions like basketball, table tennis, and other games. These sorts of competitions.
It's all part of Fu's mission at one of the world's biggest factories. A place with no boundaries between work and life. For Fu, it's a never-ending battle to keep the peace and to keep the company together.
It really is a miracle. A company this big, with all the employees together, holding hands, and moving forward. This is not easy.
And while there may be harmony inside Yupa's walls, outside, competition is cutthroat. In a global market, innovation is key. Yupa's employees must endure tough changes to survive. In the global marketplace, there's no room for second best. To survive, companies need a competitive edge. Like most China-based companies, Yupa has relied on low labor costs, making products designed by others. But it wants to move up the production food chain. Yupa's leaders want to design products of their own. They have little choice. To thrive and survive, Yupa must develop a new generation of products. The factory's very existence depends on it. Thousands of jobs hang in the balance.
No work means not being able to live. This is a fundamental requirement. It's how humans survive. You have to earn money to make a living, and to earn money, you have to work.
Ji Rong Pan knows how high the stakes are. He is Yupa's Vice President of Product Innovation.
I think innovation is the competitive edge of our company. Because our company is in the field of home appliances and the whole home appliance industry is a lifestyle industry.
Mr. Pan sent his staff overseas to study the lifestyle products of the future. They returned with a simple message. The future is green.
We studied the consumers of North America and Europe and their thoughts on this new energy of the future. So we know that their love of the earth is actually very strong.
Pan and his designers make a bold decision. The first appliance in Yupa's new product line will be powered by the sun. It's a solar CD player.
We want to bring this clean solar energy concept into people's homes.
Going solar may sound easy, but solar panels are expensive, and they're meant to work outside, not in the dim corners of people's homes. A 3D image of Yupa's appliance of the future starts to emerge. Now the team must turn a digital design into reality.
This factory is a very important part of our development process. It helps turn a product concept into a finished prototype.
Using the design specs, a computerized milling machine cuts a foam cast. And the cast is converted into a hard plastic prototype. If things go according to plan, the model will be used to produce millions of identical copies.
It allows us to test the product to see if this fulfills our requirements while bringing value to the customers.
Now engineers perfect the solar power system. The system must collect and store solar energy. Every aspect of design must maximize energy efficiency.
We've spent a lot of time studying this. What kind of technology, what kind of material, what kind of parts can help us improve our energy efficiency?
Finally, Yupa's product of the future is revealed. The solar CD player is simple and elegant. The player will charge indoors when left near a window. And the system is uniquely versatile. It will work with any energy-efficient appliance Yupa designs. But one question remains. Will the world embrace Chinese solar products?
We want to bring what people originally thought of as an industrial thing and truly integrate it into their daily lives to enable consumers to truly experience solar energy. This is a very magical energy concept.
If these innovative products succeed, Yupa could achieve its dream, a dream it shares with China, to be the factory of the world.
I want consumers and everyone to have faith in our products and faith in the workers. I hope everyone can enjoy the products we produce. This will make us proud.
With Factory City in full swing and new products in the works, more and more goods will carry the Made in China label. But for China and Factory City, growth comes at a cost. Every day, the 17,000 people at Yupa endure the stress and uncertainty of a cutthroat world economy. To fight off fierce competitors and build a better life, these men and women work and live together as one at the Factory of the World.
Well, hey, folks, and welcome to Solar Cabin Channel. I've got a neat little project for you. I call the Multi-Shack. This is one of my homeless housing solutions designs. And some of you probably don't know this, but I was homeless twice in my life. The first time was when I was trying to get into college, and I had lost my job and was waiting for my college funding to come in, and so I had to live in my truck. I lived in the cab of my truck for almost 2 months while I waited for my college funding to come in. And then again later in life when I got divorced and didn't have a job and was trying to get off grid, I lived for almost 2 years in a camp trailer. And, you know, there's a lot of people that, homeless people that have their pride. They want to maintain their independence. They don't want to live on welfare. They don't want to be caught up in the system. And, you know, all they need is a simple shelter, you know, someplace to get out of the cold, to get out of the wind, to get out of the rain, while they get back on their feet. And so I know there's a lot of organizations out there that are helping the homeless, churches, nonprofits, and things like that. So I came up with this small structure design, which I call the Multi-Shack, because it has actually multi-uses to it, and it can be built very affordably. You can build this entire shack for under $200, and it is built on wheels. It can be put on either a 4x6 trailer, or you can build it on casters. Casters are a lot less expensive, but it still allows you to move this unit around. So you could store, you know, a bunch of these on a church parking lot, and then just when you need them, you can move them out to wherever you want the person to be using them. Casters are 4-inch casters. Each caster will hold up to 240 pounds, so they'll more than handle the weight for this structure here. Now, this structure is 6'5".
Pocket, a foot without a sock. Your body gets much closer.